the quality of the facts around me. But Phaedrus was clearly a Platonist by temperament, and when the classes shifted to Plato, he was greatly relieved. His quality and Plato's good were so similar that if it hadn't been for some notes Phaedrus left, I might have thought they were identical. But he denied it, and in time I came to see how important this denial was. The course in the analysis of ideas and study of methods was not concerned with Plato's notion of the good, however. It was concerned with Plato's notion of rhetoric. Rhetoric, Plato spells out very clearly, is in no way connected with the good. Rhetoric is the bad. The people Plato hates most, next to tyrants, are rhetoricians. The first of the Platonic dialogues assigned is the Gorgias, and Phaedrus has a sense of having arrived. This at last is where he wants to be. All along he has had a feeling of being swept forward by forces he doesn't understand. Messianic forces. October has come and gone. Days have become phantasmal and incoherent, except in terms of quality. Nothing matters except that he has a new and shattering and world-shaking truth about to be born, and like it or not, the world is morally obligated to accept it. In the dialogue, Gorgias is the name of a sophist whom Socrates cross-examines. Socrates knows very well what Gorgias does for a living, and how he does it, but he starts his 20 questions dialectic by asking Gorgias with what rhetoric is concerned. Gorgias answers that it is concerned with discourse. In answer to another question, he says that its end is to persuade. In answer to another question, he says its place is in the law courts and other assemblies. And in answer to still another question, he says its subject is the just and the unjust. All this, which is simply Gorgias's description of what people called sophists have tended to do, now becomes subtly rendered by Socrates' dialectic into something else. Rhetoric has become an object, and as an object has parts, and the parts have relationships to one another, and these relations are immutable. One sees quite clearly in this dialogue how the analytic knife of Socrates hacks Gorgias's art into pieces. What is even more important, one sees that the pieces are the basis of Aristotle's art of rhetoric. Socrates has been one of Phaedrus's childhood heroes, and it shocked and angered him to see this dialogue taking place. He filled the margins of the text with answers of his own. These must have frustrated him greatly, because there was no way of knowing how the dialogue would have gone if these answers had been made. At one place, Socrates asks, "To what class of things do the words which rhetoric uses relate?" Gorgias answers, "The greatest and the best." Phaedrus, no doubt recognizing quality in this answer, has written "true" in the margin. But Socrates responds that this answer is ambiguous. He is still in the dark. "Liar," writes Phaedrus in the margin, and he cross-references a page in another dialogue, where Socrates makes it clear he could not have been in the dark. Socrates is not using dialectic to understand rhetoric. He is using it to destroy it, or at least to bring it into disrepute. And so his questions are not real questions at all. They are just word traps which Gorgias and his fellow rhetoricians fall into. Phaedrus is quite incensed by all this, and wishes he were there. In class, the professor of philosophy, noting Phaedrus's apparent good behavior and diligence, has decided he may not be such a bad student after all. This is a second mistake. He has decided to play a little game with Phaedrus by asking him what he thinks of cookery. Socrates has demonstrated to Gorgias that both rhetoric and cooking are branches of pandering, pimping, because they appeal to the emotions rather than true knowledge. In response to the professor's question, Phaedrus gives Socrates' answer that cookery is a branch of pandering. There's a titter from one of the women in the class, which displeases Phaedrus because he knows the professor is trying for a dialectical hold on him, similar to the kind Socrates gets on his opponents. And his answer is not intended to be funny, but simply to throw off the dialectical hold the professor is trying to get. Phaedrus is quite ready to recite in detail the exact arguments Socrates uses to establish this view. But that isn't what the professor wants. He wants to have a dialectical discussion in class in which he, Phaedrus, is the rhetorician and is thrown by the force of dialectic. The professor frowns and tries again. No, I mean, do you really think that a well-cooked meal served in the best of restaurants is really something that we should turn down? Phaedrus asks, you mean my personal opinion? For months now, since the innocent student disappeared, there have been no personal opinions ventured in this class. Yes, the professor says. Phaedrus is silent and tries to work out an answer. Everyone is waiting. His thoughts move up to lightning speed, winnowing through the dialectic, playing one argumentative chess opening after another, seeing that each one loses, and moving to the next one, faster and faster. But all the class witnesses is silence. Finally, in embarrassment, the professor drops the question and begins the lecture. But Phaedrus doesn't hear the lecture. His mind races on and on, through the permutations of the dialectic, on and on, hitting things, finding new branches and sub-branches, exploding with anger at each new discovery of the viciousness and meanness and lowness of this art called dialectic. The professor, looking at his expression, becomes quite alarmed, and continues the lecture in a kind of panic. Peterson's mind races on and on, and then on further, seeing now at last a kind of evil thing, an evil deeply entrenched in himself, which pretends to try to understand love and beauty and truth and wisdom, but whose real purpose is never to understand them, whose real purpose is always to usurp them and enthrone itself. Dialectic, the usurper. That is what he sees. The parvenu, muscling in on all that is good and seeking to contain it and controlling it. Evil. The professor calls the lecture to an early end and leaves the room hurriedly. After the students have filed out silently, Phaedrus sits alone at the huge round table until the sun through the sooty air beyond the window disappears, and the room becomes gray and then dark. The next day he is at the library waiting for it to open, and when it does, he begins to read furiously, back behind Plato, for the first time, into what little is known of those rhetoricians he so despised. And what he discovers begins to confirm what he has already intuited from his thoughts the evening before. Plato's condemnation of the sophists is one which many scholars have already taken with great misgivings. The chairman of the committee himself has suggested that critics who are not certain what Plato meant should be equally uncertain of what Socrates' antagonists in the dialogues meant. When it is known that Plato put his own words in Socrates' mouth, Aristotle says this, there should be no reason to doubt that he could have put his own words into other mouths, too. Fragments by other ancients seem to lead to other evaluations of the sophists. Many of the older sophists were selected as ambassadors of their cities, certainly no office of disrespect. The name sophist was even applied without disparagement to Socrates and Plato themselves. It has even been suggested by some later historians that the reason Plato hated the sophists so was that they could not compare with his master, Socrates, who was in actuality the greatest sophist of them all. This last explanation is interesting, Phaedrus thinks, but unsatisfactory. You don't abhor a school of which your master is a member. What was Plato's real purpose in this? Phaedrus reads further and further into pre-Socratic Greek thought to find out, and eventually comes to the view that Plato's hatred of the rhetoricians was part of a much larger struggle in which the reality of the good, represented by the sophists, and the reality of the true, represented by the dialecticians, were engaged in a huge struggle for the future mind of man. Truth won, the good lost, and that is why today we have so little difficulty accepting the reality of truth, and so much difficulty accepting the reality of quality, even though there is no more agreement in one area than in the other. To understand how Phaedrus arrives at this requires some explanation. One must first get over the idea that the time span between the last caveman and the first Greek philosophers was short. The absence of any history for this period sometimes gives this illusion. But before the Greek philosophers arrived in the scene, for a period of at least five times all recorded history since the Greek philosophers, there existed civilizations in an advanced state of development. They had villages and cities, vehicles, houses, marketplaces, bounded fields, agricultural implements, and domestic animals, and led a life quite as rich and varied as that in most rural areas of the world today. And like people in those areas today, they saw no reason to write it all down, or if they did, they wrote it on materials that have never been found. Thus we know nothing about them. The Dark Ages were merely the resumption of a natural way of life that had been momentarily interrupted by the Greeks. Early Greek philosophy represented the first conscious search for what was imperishable in the affairs of men. Up to then, what was imperishable was within the domain of the gods, the myths. But now, as a result of the growing impartiality of the Greeks to the world around them, there was an increasing power of abstraction which permitted them to regard the old Greek mythos not as revealed truth, but as imaginative creations of art. This consciousness, which had never existed anywhere before in the world, spelled a whole new level of transcendence for the Greek civilization. But the mythos goes on, and that which destroys the old mythos becomes the new mythos. And the new mythos, under the first Ionian philosophers, became transmuted into philosophy, which enshrined permanence in a new way. Permanence was no longer the exclusive domain of the immortal gods. It was also to be found within immortal principles, of which our current law of gravity has become one. The immortal principle was first called water by Thales. Anaximenes called it air. The Pythagoreans called it number, and were thus the first to see the immortal principle as something non-material. Heraclitus called the immortal principle fire, and introduced change as part of the principle. He said the world exists as a conflict and tension of opposites. He said there is a one, and there is a many, and the one is the universal law, which is immanent in all things. Anaxagoras was the first to identify the one as nous, meaning mind. Parmenides made it clear for the first time that the immortal principle, the one, truth, God, is separate from appearance and from opinion. And the importance of this separation and its effect upon subsequent history cannot be overstated. It's here that the classic mind, for the first time, took leave of its romantic origins and said, "The good and the true are not necessarily the same," and goes its separate way. Anaxagoras and Parmenides had a listener named Socrates who carried their ideas into full fruition. What is essential to understand at this point is that until now, there was no such thing as mind and matter, subject and object, form and substance. Those divisions are just dialectical inventions that came later. The modern mind sometimes tends to balk at the thought of these dichotomies being inventions, and says, well, the divisions were there for the Greeks to discover, and you have to say, where were they? Point to them. And the modern mind gets a little confused and wonders what this is all about anyway, and still believes the divisions were there. But they weren't, as Phaedrus said. They were just ghosts. Immortal ghosts of the modern mythos, which appear to us to be real because we are in that mythos. But in reality, they are just as much an artistic creation as the anthropomorphic gods they replaced. The pre-Socratic philosophers mentioned so far all sought to establish a universal immortal principle in the external world they found around them. Their common effort united them into a group that may be called cosmologists. They all agreed that such a principle existed, but their disagreements as to what it was seemed irresolvable. The followers of Heraclitus insisted the immortal principle was change in motion, but Parmenides' disciple Zeno proved, through a series of paradoxes, that any perception of motion and change is illusory. Reality had to be motionless. The resolution of the arguments of the cosmologists came from a new direction entirely, from a group Phaedrus seemed to feel were early humanists. They were teachers, but what they sought to teach was not principles, but beliefs of men. Their object was not any single absolute truth, but the improvement of men. All principles, all truths, are relative, they said. Man is the measure of all things. These were the famous teachers of wisdom, the sophists of ancient Greece. To Phaedrus, this backlight from the conflict between the sophists and the cosmologists adds an entirely new dimension to the dialogues of Plato. Socrates is not just expounding noble ideas in a vacuum. He is in the middle of a war between those who think truth is absolute and those who think truth is relative. He is fighting that war with everything he has. The sophists are the enemy. Now Plato's hatred of the sophists makes sense. He and Socrates are defending the immortal principle of the cosmologists against what they consider to be the decadence of the sophists. Truth, knowledge, that which is independent of what anyone thinks about it. The ideal that Socrates died for, the ideal that Greece alone possesses for the first time in the history of the world. It is still a very fragile thing. It can disappear completely. Plato abhors and damns the sophists without restraint, not because they are low and immoral people. There are obviously much lower and more immoral people in Greece he completely ignores. He damns them because they threaten mankind's first beginning grasp of the idea of truth. That's what it is all about. The results of Socrates' martyrdom and Plato's unexcelled prose that followed are nothing less than the whole world of Western man as we know it. If the idea of truth had been allowed to perish, unrediscovered by the Renaissance, it's unlikely that we would be much beyond the level of prehistoric man today. The ideas of science and technology, and other systematically organized efforts of man, are dead-centered on it. It is the nucleus of it all. And yet Phaedrus understands what he is saying about quality is somehow opposed to all this. It seems to agree much more closely with the sophists. Man is the measure of all things. Yes, that's what he is saying about quality. Man is not the source of all things, as the subjective idealists would say, nor is he the passive observer of all things, as the objective idealists and materialists would say. The quality which creates the world emerges as a relationship between man and his experience. He is a participant in the creation of all things, the measure of all things. It fits. And they taught rhetoric. That fits. The one thing that doesn't fit what he says and what Plato said about the sophists is their profession of teaching virtue. All accounts indicate this was absolutely central to their teaching. But how are you going to teach virtue if you teach the relativity of all ethical ideas? Virtue, if it implies anything at all, implies an ethical absolute. A person whose idea of what is proper varies from day to day can be admired for his broad-mindedness, but not for his virtue. Not at least as Phaedrus understands the word. And how could they get virtue out of rhetoric? This is never explained anywhere. Something is missing. His search for it takes him through a number of histories of ancient Greece, which, as usual, he reads detective style, looking only for facts that may help him and discarding all those that don't fit. And he is reading H.D.F. Kiddo's The Greeks, a blue and white paperback which he has bought for 50 cents, and he has reached a passage that describes the very soul of the Homeric hero, the legendary figure of pre-decadent, pre-Socratic Greece. The flash of illumination that follows these pages is so intense, the heroes are never erased, and I can see them with little effort of recall. The Iliad is the story of the siege of Troy, which will fall in the dust, and of its defenders who will be killed in battle. The wife of Hector, the leader, says to him, "Your strength will be your destruction, and you have no pity either for your infant son or for your unhappy wife, who will soon be your widow. For soon the Achaeans will set upon you and kill you. And if I lose you, it would be better for me to die." Her husband replies, "Well do I know this, and I am sure of it. That day is coming when the holy city of Troy will perish, and Priam, and the people of wealthy Priam. But my grief is not so much for the Trojans, nor for Hecuba herself, nor for Priam the king, nor for my many noble brothers who will be slain by the foe and will lie in the dust. As for you, when one of the bronze-clad Achaeans will carry you away in tears and end your days of freedom. Then you may live in Argos and work at the loom in another woman's house, or perhaps carry water for a woman of Mycenae or Hyperia, sore against your will. But hard compulsion will lie upon you, And then a man will say as he sees you weeping, "This was the wife of Hector, who was the noblest in battle of the horse-taming Trojans when they were fighting round Ilion." This is what they will say. And it will be fresh grief for you to fight against slavery, bereft of a husband like that. But may I be dead, may the earth be heaped over my grave before I hear your cries, and of the violence done to you. So spake shining Hector, and held out his arms to his son. But the child screamed and shrank back into the bosom of the well-girdled nurse, for he took fright at the sight of his dear father, at the bronze and the crest of the horsehair which he saw swaying terribly from the top of the helmet. His father laughed aloud, and his lady mother too. At once shining Hector took the helmet off his head and laid it on the ground, and when he had kissed his dear son and dandled him in his arms, he prayed to Zeus and to the other gods. "Zeus and ye other gods, grant that this my son may be as I am, most glorious among the Trojans, and a man of might, and greatly rule in Ilion. And may they say, as he returns from war, he is far better than his father." What moves the Greek warrior to deeds of heroism, Kitto comments, is not a sense of duty as we understand it, duty towards others. It is rather duty towards himself. He strives after that which we translate virtue, but is in Greek arete, excellence. We shall have much to say about arete. It runs through Greek life. There, Phaedrus thinks, is a definition of quality that had existed 1,000 years before the dialecticians ever thought to put it to word traps. Anyone who cannot understand this meaning without logical definiens and definendum and differentia is either lying or so out of touch with the common lot of humanity as to be unworthy of receiving any reply whatsoever. Phaedrus is fascinated, too, by the description of the motive of duty towards self, which is an almost exact translation of the Sanskrit word dharma, sometimes described as the one of the Hindus. Can the dharma of the Hindus and the virtue of the ancient Greeks be identical? Then Phaedrus feels a tugging to read the passage again, and he does so, and then, what's this? That we translate virtue, but as in Greek, excellence. Lightning hits. Quality, virtue, dharma. That is what the sophists were teaching. Not ethical relativism, not pristine virtue, but arete, excellence, dharma. Before the Church of Reason, before substance, before form, before mind and matter, before dialectic itself, quality had been absolute. Those first teachers of the Western world were teaching quality, and the medium they had chosen was that of rhetoric. He has been doing it right all along. The rain has lifted enough so that we can see the horizon now, a sharp line demarking the light gray of the sky and the darker gray of the water. Kitto had more to say about this arete of the ancient Greeks. "When we meet arete in Plato," he said, "we translate it virtue and consequently miss all the flavor of it. Virtue, at least in modern English, is almost entirely a moral word. Arete, on the other hand, is used indifferently in all the categories and simply means excellence. Thus the hero of the Odyssey is a great fighter, a wily schemer, a ready speaker, a man of stout heart and broad wisdom who knows that he must endure without too much complaining what the gods send. And he can both build and sail a boat, drive a furrow straight as anyone, beat a young braggart at throwing the discus, challenge the Phoenician youth at boxing, wrestling, or running, flay, skin, cut up, and cook an ox, and be moved to tears by a song. He is, in fact, an excellent all-rounder. He has surpassing arete. Arete implies a respect for the wholeness or oneness of life and a consequent dislike of specialization. It implies a contempt for efficiency, or rather, a much higher idea of efficiency, an efficiency which exists not in one department of life, but in life itself. Phaedrus remembered a line from Thoreau. you never gain something, but that you lose something. And now he began to see for the first time the unbelievable magnitude of what man, when he gained power to understand and rule the world in terms of dialectic truths, had lost. He had built empires of scientific capability to manipulate the phenomena of nature into enormous manifestations of his own dreams of power and wealth. But for this he had exchanged an empire of understanding of equal magnitude, an understanding of what it is to be a part of the world and not an enemy of it. One can acquire some peace of mind from just watching that horizon. It's a geometer's line, completely flat, steady, and known. Perhaps it's the original line that gave rise to Euclid's understanding of lineness, a reference line from which was derived the original calculations of the first astronomers that charted the stars. Phaedrus knew, with the same mathematical assurance Poincaré had felt when he resolved the Fuchsian equations, that this Greek arete was the missing piece that completed the pattern. But he read on now for completion. The halo around the heads of Plato and Socrates is now gone. He sees that they consistently are doing exactly that which they accuse the sophists of doing, using emotionally persuasive language for the ulterior purpose of making the weaker argument, the case for dialectic, appear the stronger. We always condemn most in others, he thought, that which we most fear in ourselves. But why, Phaedrus wondered, why destroy arete? And no sooner had he asked the question than the answer came to him. Plato hadn't tried to destroy arete. He had encapsulated it, made a permanent fixed idea out of it, had converted it to a rigid, immobile, immortal truth. He made arete the good, the highest form, the highest idea of all. It was subordinate only to truth itself, in a synthesis of all that had gone before. That was why the quality that Phaedrus had arrived at in the classroom had seemed so close to Plato's good. Plato's good was taken from the rhetoricians. Phaedrus searched, but could find no previous cosmologists who had talked about the good. That was from the sophists. The difference was that Plato's good was a fixed and eternal and unmoving idea, whereas from the rhetoricians, it was not an idea at all. The good was not a form of reality. It was reality itself, ever-changing, ultimately unknowable, in any kind of fixed, rigid way. Why had Plato done this? Phaedrus saw Plato's philosophy as a result of two syntheses. The first synthesis tried to resolve differences between the Heraclitans and the followers of Parmenides. Both cosmological schools upheld immortal truth. In order to win the battle for truth in which arete is subordinate, against his enemies who would teach arete in which truth is subordinate, Plato must first resolve the internal conflict among the truth believers. To do this, he says that immortal truth is not just change, as the followers of Heraclitus said. It is not just changeless being, as the followers of Parmenides said. Both these immortal truths coexist as ideas, which are changeless, and appearance, which changes. That is why Plato finds it necessary to separate, for example, hoarseness from horse, and say that hoarseness is real and fixed and true and unmoving, while the horse is a mere unimportant transitory phenomenon. Hoarseness is pure idea. The horse that one sees is a collection of changing appearances, a horse that can flux and move around all it wants to and even die on the spot without disturbing hoarseness, which is the immortal principle and can go on forever in the path of the gods of old. Plato's second synthesis is the incorporation of the sophist's arete into this dichotomy of ideas and appearance. He gives it the position of highest honor, subordinate only to truth itself, and the method by which truth is arrived at, the dialectic. But in his attempt to unite the good and the true by making the good the highest idea of all, Plato is nevertheless usurping arete's place with dialectically determined truth. Once the good has been contained as a dialectical idea, it is no trouble for another philosopher to come along and show by dialectical methods that arete, the good, can be more advantageously demoted to a lower position within a true order of things, more compatible with the inner workings of dialectic. Such a philosopher was not long in coming. His name was Aristotle. Aristotle felt that the mortal horse of appearance, which ate grass and took people places and gave birth to little horses, deserved far more attention than Plato was giving it. He said that the horse is not mere appearance. The appearances cling to something which is independent of them, and which, like ideas, is unchanging. The something that appearances cling to he named substance. And at that moment, and not until that moment, our modern scientific understanding of reality was born. Under Aristotle the reader, whose knowledge of Trojan arete seems conspicuously absent, forms and substances dominate all. The good is a relatively minor branch of knowledge called ethics. Reason, logic, knowledge are his primary concerns. Arete is dead, and science, logic, and the university as we know it today have been given their founding charter. To find and invent an endless proliferation of forms about the substantive elements of the world, and call these forms knowledge, and transmit these forms to future generations as the system. And rhetoric? Poor rhetoric, once learning itself, now becomes reduced to the teaching of mannerisms and forms. Aristotelian forms, for writing, as if these mattered. 5 spelling errors, Phaedrus remembered, or 1 error of sentence completeness, or 3 misplaced modifiers, or... It went on and on. Any of these was sufficient to inform a student that he did not know rhetoric. After all, that's what rhetoric is, isn't it? Of course, there's empty rhetoric, that is, rhetoric that has emotional appeal without proper subservience to dialectical truth. But we don't want any of that, do we? That would make us like those liars and cheats and defilers of ancient Greece, the sophists. Remember them? We'll learn the truth in other academic courses, and then learn a little rhetoric so that we can write it nicely and impress our bosses who will advance us to higher positions. Forms and mannerisms, hated by the best, loved by the worst. Year after year, decade after decade of little front-row readers, mimics with pretty smiles and neat pens, out to get their Aristotelian A's, while those who possess the real arete sit silently in back of them wondering what is wrong with themselves that they cannot like this subject. And today, in those few universities that bother to teach classic ethics anymore, students, following the lead of Aristotle and Plato, endlessly play around with a question that in ancient Greece never needed to be asked. What is the good? And how do we define it? Since different people have defined it differently, how can we know there is any good? Some say the good is found in happiness, but how do we know what happiness is? And how can happiness be defined? Happiness and good are not objective terms. We cannot deal with them scientifically, and since they aren't objective, they just exist in your mind. So if you want to be happy, just change your mind. Ha 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 ha. Aristotelian ethics, Aristotelian definitions, Aristotelian logic, Aristotelian forms, Aristotelian substances, Aristotelian rhetoric, Aristotelian laughter. Ha 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 ha. And the bones of the sophists long ago turned to dust, and what they said turned to dust with them. And the dust was buried under the rubble of declining Athens through its fall, and Macedonia through its decline and fall, through the decline and death of ancient Rome and Byzantium and the Ottoman Empire and the modern states, buried so deep and with such ceremoniousness and such unction and such evil that only a madman centuries later could discover the clues needed to uncover them and see with horror what had been done. The road has become so dark I have to turn on my headlight now to follow it through these mists and rain. Chapter 30. At Arcata, we enter a small diner, cold and wet, and eat chili and beans and drink coffee. Then we are back on the road again, freeway now, fast and wet. We'll go to within an easy day's distance from San Francisco and then stop. The freeway picks up strange reflections in the rain from oncoming lights across the median. The rain hits like pellets against the bubble, which refracts the lights in strange circular and then semicircular waves as they go by. 20th century. It's all around us now, this 20th century. Time to finish this 20th century odyssey of Phaedrus and be done with it. The next time the class in Ideas and Methods 251, Rhetoric, met at the large round table in South Chicago, a department secretary announced that the professor of philosophy was ill. The following week, he was still ill. The somewhat bewildered remnants of the class, which had dwindled to a third of its size, went on their own across the street for coffee. At the coffee table, a student whom Phaedrus had marked as bright but intellectually snobbish said, "I consider this one of the most unpleasant classes I've ever been in." He seemed to look down on Phaedrus with womanish peevishness as a spoiler of what should have been a nice experience. "I thoroughly agree," Phaedrus said. He waited for some sort of attack, but it didn't come. The other students seemed to sense that Phaedrus was the cause of all this, but they had nothing to go on. Then an older woman at the other end of the coffee table asked why he was attending the class. "I'm in the process of trying to discover that," Phaedrus said. "Do you attend full-time?" she asked. "No, I teach full-time at Navy Pier." "What do you teach?" "Rhetoric." She stopped talking, and everyone at the table looked at him and became silent. November wore on. The leaves, which had turned a beautiful sunlit orange in October, fell from the trees, leaving barren branches to meet the cold winds from the north. A first snow fell, then melted, and a drab city waited for winter to come. In the professor of philosophy's absence, another Platonic dialogue had been assigned. Its title was Phaedrus, which meant nothing to our Phaedrus since he didn't call himself by that name. The Greek Phaedrus is not a sophist but a young orator who is a foil for Socrates in this dialogue, which is about the nature of love and the possibility of philosophic rhetoric. Phaedrus doesn't appear to be very bright and has an awful sense of rhetorical quality, since he quotes from memory a really bad speech by the orator Lysias. But one soon learns that this bad speech is simply a setup, an easy act for Socrates to follow with a much better speech of his own, and following that with a still better speech, one of the finest in all the dialogues of Plato. Beyond that, the only remarkable thing about Phaedrus is his personality. Plato often names Socrates' foils for characteristics of their personality. A young, overtalkative, innocent, and good-natured foil in the Gorgias is named Polus, which is Greek for colt. Phaedrus's personality is different from this. He is unallied to any particular group. He prefers the solitude of the country to the city. He is aggressive to the point of being dangerous. At one point he threatens Socrates with violence. Phaedrus in Greek means wolf. In this dialogue he is carried away by Socrates' discourse on love and is tamed. Our Phaedrus reads the dialogue and is tremendously impressed by the magnificent poetic imagery. But he's not tamed by it because he also smells in it a faint odor of hypocrisy. The speech is not an end in itself, but is being used to condemn that same affective domain of understanding it makes its rhetorical appeal to. The passions are characterized as the destroyer of understanding, and Phaedrus wonders if this is where the condemnation of the passions so deeply buried in Western thought got its start. Probably not. The tension between ancient Greek thought and emotion is described elsewhere as basic to Greek makeup and culture. Interesting, though. The next week, the professor of philosophy again does not appear, and Phaedrus uses the time to catch up on his work at the University of Illinois. The next week, in the University of Chicago bookstore, across the street from where he is about to attend class, Phaedrus sees two dark eyes that stare at him steadily through a shelf of books. When the face appears, he recognizes it as the face of the innocent student who had been verbally beaten up earlier in the quarter and had disappeared. The face looks as though the student knows something Phaedrus doesn't know. Phaedrus walks over to talk, but the face retreats and goes out the door, leaving Phaedrus puzzled. And on edge. Perhaps he's just fatigued and jumpy. The exhaustion of teaching at Navy Pier on top of the effort to outflank the whole body of Western academic thought at the University of Chicago is forcing him to work and study 20 hours a day with inadequate attention to food or exercise. It could be just fatigue that makes him think something is odd about that face. But when he walks across the street to the class, the face follows about 20 paces behind. Something is up. Phaedrus enters the classroom and waits. Soon there comes the student again back into the room after all these weeks. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 10, Side 2. Soon there comes the student again, back into the room after all these weeks. He can't expect to get credit now. The student looks at Phaedrus with a half-smile. He's smiling at something, all right. At the doorway, there are some footsteps, and then suddenly Phaedrus knows, and his legs turn rubbery and his hands start to shake. Smiling benignly in the doorway stands none other than the chairman for the Committee on Analysis of Ideas and Study of Methods at the University of Chicago. He is taking over the class. This is it. This is where they throw Phaedrus out the front door. Courtly, grand, with imperial magnanimity, the chairman stands in the doorway for a moment, then talks to a student who seems to know him. He smiles while looking away from the student, around the classroom, as if to find another face that is familiar to him, nods, and then chuckles a little, waiting for the bell to ring. That's why that kid is here. They've explained to him why they accidentally beat him up, and just to show what good guys they are, they're going to let him have a ringside seat while they beat up Phaedrus. How are they going to do it? Phaedrus already knows. First, they're going to destroy this status dialectically in front of the class by showing how little he knows about Plato and Aristotle. That won't be any trouble. Obviously, they know 100 times more about Plato and Aristotle than he ever will. They've been at it all their lives. Then, when they have thoroughly cut him up dialectically, they will suggest that he either shape up or get out. Then they are going to ask some more questions, and he won't know the answers to those either. Then they are going to suggest that his performance is so abominable that he not bother to attend but leave the class right now. There are variations possible, but this is the basic format. It's so easy. Well, he has learned a lot, which is what he has come for. He can do his thesis in some other way. With that thought, the rubbery feeling leaves him, and he calms down. Phaedrus has grown a beard since the chairman last saw him, and so is still unidentified. No long advantage. The chairman will locate him soon enough. The chairman lays his coat down carefully, takes a chair on the opposite side of the large round table, sits, and then brings out an old pipe and stuffs it for what must be nearly a half a minute. One can see he has done this many times before. In a moment of attention to the class, he studies faces with a smiling, hypnotic gaze, sensing the mood, but feeling it is not just right. He stuffs the pipe some more, but without hurry. Soon the moment arrives, he lights the pipe, and before long, there is in the classroom an odor of smoke. At last he speaks. "It is my understanding," he says, "that today we are to begin discussion of the immortal Phaedrus." He looks at each student separately. "Is that correct?" Members of the class assure him timidly that it is. His persona is overwhelming. The chairman then apologizes for the absence of the previous professor and describes the format of what will follow. Since he already knows the dialogue himself, he will elicit from the class answers that will show how well they have studied it. That's the best way to do it, Phaedrus thinks. That way one can learn to know the individual students. Fortunately, Phaedrus has studied the dialogue so carefully, it is almost memorized. The chairman is right. It is an immortal dialogue, strange and puzzling at first, but then hitting you harder and harder, like truth itself. What Phaedrus has been talking about as quality, Socrates appears to have described as the soul, self-moving, the source of all things. There is no contradiction. There never really can be between the core terms of monistic philosophies. The one in India has got to be the same as the one in Greece. If it's not, you've got two. The only disagreements among the monists concern the attributes of the one, not the one itself. Since the one is the source of all things and includes all things in it, it cannot be defined in terms of those things, since no matter what thing you use to define it, the thing will always describe something less than the one itself. The one can only be described allegorically, through the use of analogy, of figures of imagination and speech. Socrates chooses a heaven and earth analogy, showing how individuals are drawn toward the one by a chariot drawn by two horses. But the chairman now directs a question to the student next to Phaedrus. He is baiting him a little, provoking him to attack. The student, whose identity is mistaken, doesn't attack, and the chairman, with great disgust and frustration, finally dismisses him with a rebuke that he should have read the material better. Phaedrus's turn. He has calmed down tremendously. He must now explain the dialogue. "If I may be permitted to begin again in my own way," he says, partly to conceal the fact that he didn't hear what the previous student said. The chairman, seeing this as a further rebuke to the student next to him, smiles and says contemptuously, "It is certainly a good idea." Phaedrus proceeds. "I believe that in this dialogue the person of Phaedrus is characterized as a wolf." He has delivered this loudly, with a flash of anger, and the chairman almost jumps. "Score." "Yes," the chairman says, and a gleam in his eye shows he now recognizes who his bearded assailant is. "Phaedrus in Greek does mean wolf. That's a very acute observation." He begins to recover his composure. "Proceed." "Phaedrus meets Socrates, who knows only the ways of the city, and leads him into the country, whereupon he begins to recite a speech of the orator Lysias, whom he admires. Socrates asks him to read it, and Phaedrus does."
"Stop,"
says the chairman, who has now completely recovered his composure. "You are giving us the plot, not the dialogue." He calls on the next student. None of the students seem to know to the chairman's satisfaction what the dialogue is about, and so with mock sadness he says they must all read more thoroughly, but this time he will help them by taking on the burden of explaining the dialogue himself. This provides an overwhelming relief to the tension he has so carefully built up, and the entire class is in the palm of his hand. The chairman proceeds to reveal the meaning of the dialogue with complete attention. Phaedrus listens with deep engagement. After a time, something begins to disengage him a little. A false note of some kind has crept in. At first he doesn't see what it is, but then he becomes aware that the chairman has completely bypassed Socrates' description of the one, and has jumped ahead to the allegory of the chariot and the horses. In this allegory, the seeker, trying to reach the one, is drawn by two horses, one white and noble and temperate, and the other surly, stubborn, passionate, and black. The one is forever aiding him in his upward journey to the portals of heaven. The other is forever confounding him. The chairman has not stated it yet, but he is at the point at which he must now announce that the white horse is temperate reason, the black horse is dark passion, emotion. He is at the point at which these must be described, but the false note suddenly becomes a chorus. He backs up and restates that, "Now Socrates has sworn to the gods that he is telling the truth. He has taken an oath to speak the truth, and if what follows is not the truth, he has forfeited his own soul." Trap. He's using the dialogue to prove the holiness of reason. Once that's established, he can move down into inquiries of what reason is, and then, lo and behold, there we are in Aristotle's domain again. Phaedrus raises his hand, palm flat out, elbow on the table. Where before this hand was shaking, it is now deadly calm. Phaedrus senses that he now is formally signing his own death warrant here, but knows he will sign another kind of death warrant if he takes his hand down. The chairman sees the hand, is surprised and disturbed by it, but acknowledges it. Then the message is delivered. Phaedrus says, "All this is just an analogy." Silence. And then confusion appears in the chairman's face.
"What?"
he says. The spell of his performance is broken. "This entire description of the chariot and horses is just an analogy."
"What?"
he says again, then loudly.
"It is the truth. Socrates has sworn to the gods that it is the truth."
Phaedrus replies, "Socrates himself says it is an analogy."
If you will read the dialogue, you will find that Socrates specifically states it is the truth.
Yes, but prior to that, in, I believe, two paragraphs, he has stated that it is an analogy. The text is on the table to consult, but the chairman has enough sense not to consult it. If he does, and Phaedrus is right, his classroom face is completely demolished. He has told the class no one has read the book thoroughly. Rhetoric 1, Dialect 0. Fantastic, Phaedrus thinks, that he should have remembered that. It just demolishes the whole dialectical position. That may just be the whole show right there. Of course it's an analogy. Everything is an analogy. But the dialecticians don't know that. That's why the chairman missed that statement of Socrates. Phaedrus has caught it and remembered it because if Socrates hadn't stated it, he wouldn't have been telling the truth. No one sees it yet, but they will soon enough. The chairman of the Committee on Analysis of Ideas and Study of Methods has just been shot down in his own classroom. Now he is speechless. He can't think of a word to say. The silence, which so built his image at the beginning of the class, is now destroying it. He doesn't understand from where the shot has come. He has never confronted a living sophist. Only dead ones. Now he tries to grasp onto something, but there is nothing to grasp onto. His own momentum carries him forward into the abyss, and when he finally finds words, they are the words of another kind of person. A schoolboy who has forgotten his lesson, has gotten it wrong, but would like our indulgence anyway. He tries to bluff the class with the statement he made before that no one has studied very well, but the student to Phaedrus's right shakes his head at him. Obviously someone has. The chairman falters and hesitates, acts afraid of his class, and does not really engage them. Phaedrus wonders what the consequences of this will be. Then he sees a bad thing happen. The beat-up innocent student, who has watched him earlier, now is no longer so innocent. He is sneering at the chairman and asking him sarcastic and insinuating questions. The chairman, already crippled, is now being killed. But then Phaedrus realizes this was what was intended for himself. He can't feel sorry, just disgusted. When a shepherd goes to kill a wolf and takes his dog to see the sport, he should take care to avoid mistakes. The dog has certain relationships to the wolf the shepherd may have forgotten. A girl rescues the chairman by asking easy questions. He receives the questions with gratitude, answers each at great length, and slowly recovers himself. Then the question is asked him, "What is dialectic?" He thinks about it, and then, by God, turns to Phaedrus and asks if he would care to answer. "You mean, what is my personal opinion?" Phaedrus asks. "No, let us say, Aristotle's opinion." No subtleties now. He is just going to get Phaedrus on his own territory and let him have it. "As best I know," Phaedrus says, and pauses. "Yes?" The chairman is all smiles. Everything is all set. "As best I know, Aristotle's opinion is that dialectic comes before everything else." The chairman's expression goes from unction to shock to rage in one half-second flat. It does. His face shouts, but he never says it. The trapper trapped again. He can't kill Phaedrus on a statement taken from his own article in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Rhetoric 2, Dialect 0. "And from the dialectic comes the forms," Phaedrus continues, "and from..." But the chairman cuts it off. He sees it cannot go his way and dismisses it. He shouldn't have cut it off, Phaedrus thinks to himself. Were he a real truth-seeker and not a propagandist for a particular point of view, he would not. He might learn something. Once it's stated that the dialectic comes before anything else, this statement itself becomes a dialectical entity, subject to dialectical question. Phaedrus would have asked, "What evidence do we have that the dialectical question and answer method of arriving at truth comes before anything else?" We have none whatsoever. And when the statement is isolated and itself subject to scrutiny, it becomes patently ridiculous. Here is this dialectic, like Newton's law of gravity, just sitting by itself in the middle of nowhere, giving birth to the universe? Hey, it's asinine. Dialectic, which is the parent of logic, came itself from rhetoric. Rhetoric is in turn the child of the myths and poetry of ancient Greece. That is so historically, and that is so by any application of common sense. The poetry and the myths are the response of a prehistoric people to the universe around them, made on the basis of quality. It is quality, not dialectic, which is the generator of everything we know. The class ends, the chairman stands by the door answering questions, and Phaedrus almost goes up to say something, but does not. A lifetime of blows tends to make a person unenthusiastic about any unnecessary interchange that might lead to more. Nothing friendly has been said, or even hinted at, and much hostility has been shown. Phaedrus the Wolf. It fits. Walking back to his apartment with light steps, he sees it fits more and more. He wouldn't be happy if they were overjoyed with the thesis. Hostility is really his element. It really is.
Phaedrus the Wolf,
yes,
down from the mountains to prey upon the poor, innocent citizens of this intellectual community.
It fits all right.
The Church of Reason, like all institutions of the system, is based not on individual strength, but upon individual weakness. What's really demanded in the Church of Reason is not ability, but inability. Then you are considered teachable. A truly able person is always a threat. Phaedrus sees that he has thrown away a chance to integrate himself into the organization by submitting to whatever Aristotelian thing he is supposed to submit to. But that kind of opportunity seems hardly worth the bowing and scraping and intellectual prostration necessary to maintain it. It is a low-quality form of life. For him, quality is better seen up at the timberline than here, obscured by smoky windows and oceans of words, and he sees that what he is talking about can never really be accepted here because to see it, one has to be free from social authority, and this is an institution of social authority. Quality for sheep is what the shepherd says, and if you take a sheep and put it up at the timberline at night when the wind is roaring, that sheep will be panicked half to death and will call and call until the shepherd comes, or comes the wolf. He makes one last attempt somehow to be nice at the next session of the class, but the chairman isn't having any. Phaedrus asks him to explain a point, saying he hasn't been able to understand it. He has, but thinks it would be nice to defer a little. The answer is, maybe you got tired, delivered as scathingly as possible. But it doesn't scathe. The chairman is simply condemning in Phaedrus that which he most fears in himself. As the class goes on, Phaedrus sits staring out the window, feeling sorry for this old shepherd and his classroom sheep and dogs, and sorry for himself, that he will never be one of them. Then, when the bell rings, he leaves forever. The classes at Navy Pier, by contrast, are going like wildfire, the students now listening intently to this strange bearded figure from the mountains, who is telling them there was such a thing as quality in this universe, and they know what it is. They don't know what to make of it, are unsure. Some of them are afraid of him. They can see he is somehow dangerous, but all are fascinated and want to hear more. But Phaedrus is no shepherd either, and the strain of behaving like one is killing him. A strange thing that has always occurred in classes occurs again, when the unruly and wild students in the back rows have always empathized with him and been his favorites, while the more sheepish and obedient students in the front rows have always been terrorized by him, and are because of this objects of his contempt, even though in the end the sheep have passed and his unruly friends in the back rows have not. And Phaedrus sees, though he does not want to admit it to himself even now, he sees intuitively, nevertheless, that his days as a shepherd are coming to an end too. And he wonders more and more what is going to happen next. He has always feared the silence in the classroom, the sort that has destroyed the chairman. It is not his nature to talk and talk and talk for hours on end, and it exhausts him to do this. And now, having nothing left to turn upon, he turns upon this fear. He comes to the classroom, the bell rings, and Phaedrus sits there and does not talk. For the entire hour he is silent.
Some of the students challenge him a little to wake him up, but then are silent. Others are going straight out of their minds with internal panic. At the end of the hour, the whole class literally breaks and